And this lecture is really fun. It's one of the few times we get to talk about things like murderous rages and sexual urges, deeply buried unconscious wishes to sleep with your mother and kill your father. That's the topic of today's lecture. So we'll be covering the basics of psychodynamic theory, psychoanalytic theory. So this dates back to Freud. Some of you may have had some exposure, lots of exposure. Some of you may find this all very new and interesting. It is a theory that gave rise to a therapy and gave rise to a wealth of concepts that you use on a daily basis and may not even know or trace back to its true roots in psychodynamic thinking. So we'll talk about some of the theory, and we'll also focus mostly on the defense mechanisms that arose out of psychodynamic theory, because those defense mechanisms have become such a part of common parlance, and they tend to operate more in stressful situations with you as physicians. We'll be encountering in your patients very life-changing, stressful situations. And the defense mechanisms, to be quite pragmatic about it, are commonly found on most of your exams. And so even last year, I had students tell me, wow, I can't believe how many questions on the defense mechanisms were on the BSCE. So as much as you want to kind of disregard psychodynamic theory or therapies, some of you might really get into it. But the truth is, you do have to know the defense mechanism. So we'll spend a lot of time on those. And you'll notice there's a lot of slides today. We may not get through all of them. Some of them are more for your interest and be able to review on your own, because we just won't have the time to discuss all of it. And psychodynamic theory is rich and extensive. So we'll get to as much as we can, but with a real focus on the defense mechanisms. So how many of you believe that we have an unconscious mind? And in that mind, we have fantasies, memories, desires, fears, all outside of our awareness. Okay, 92% of you say yes. I mean, this is the basis for psychodynamic theory. Now, Freud didn't invent the unconscious. Freud introduced a theory that made use of the unconscious, which was a concept that was very much... Yes, sorry, there's already a question. What's that? Sure. Is everyone okay with that? Okay, click back in. Okay. Everyone make it? Yes? So, Freud didn't discover the unconscious. If you're interested in the topic of the unconscious, there's a great history. It's a book by Henry Ellenberger called The Discovery of the Unconscious, and it's really interesting. But so Freud was operating or practicing, he was a neurologist in the time where the unconscious was kind of in vogue because people were using hypnosis. And he developed his theory with the understanding that the unconscious might be the clue to some of the psychiatric symptoms they were attempting to treat. So he developed an all-encompassing theory of personality and a treatment model, and the emphasis was on unconscious conflict between our biological drives and society's prohibitions. And so in the term psychodynamic, the word dynamic refers to the dynamics of this conflict between the unconscious and the conscious mind, which will further differentiate into the id, ego, and superego, and along with Freud's model. So in the psychoanalytic view, psychopathology results when this type of intrapsychic conflict, meaning our desire, our intense lustful desires for someone we're not supposed to desire. In Freud's case, it was usually the parent, the mother, or the father. Society would tell us we have to inhibit that, and that would cause a conflict. Now, on a more benign sense, maybe it's a child who has, you know, desires and grows up where you're not supposed to have sex until you're married, and so they suppress these desires, and so sometimes these libidinal drives are in conflict with society's prohibitions, and it's that conflict that gives rise to psychopathology in Freudian view. Now, Freudian or psychoanalysis is very subjective for people, for psychiatrists. If you eventually go into psychiatry and you have a real interest in this, you find that the people who can tolerate this type of practice happen to have a little more of an artistic side. They don't mind employing metaphor or working in the realm of symbols, symbolic thinking, where patients bring things to the room which, you know, if you have a logical, clear mind and you only want to like follow a logical thread between things, psychoanalysis is not for you. It's more for people who can tolerate some ambiguity and playfulness to arrive at some idea of what the patient might be unconsciously defending against. So the view is most human behavior is determined by forces that are outside of our awareness. Now that's different than what we've talked about with learning theory, right? Or learning or behavioral therapies, where we can be aware of our dysfunctional attitudes and our traits, our habits, and we can change them. In psychodynamic theory, a lot of this is outside of our awareness. And so we can only, through therapy, become aware of these unconscious drives and the conflict. And then hopefully through insight approach, are these wishes or desires in a more mature way, or kind of channel them with a more mature defense strategy, which we'll talk about. So these drives push for satisfaction, but we exclude them from consciousness, and it's this conflict that gives rise to our behavior. So in the Freudian sense, our behavior is often riddled with funny defensive mechanisms that distort reality. Okay, and by the end of this lecture, you're going to know what those are. When I talked about with patients how they engage in self-deception, again, by the end of this lecture, you'll know what I mean by that. So in Freud's topographic model, so if you ever see a question that refers to this topographic model, it's as simple as this. There is the unconscious, and the unconscious is beneath. So here, let's say, is the conscious mind, what we have access to in our conscious mind. And we have the subconscious, which essentially with enough attention or awareness, we can access contents in the subconscious. But the unconscious is inaccessible to our awareness in the Freudian topographic model. Now, in the unconscious, we house these what we call societally undesirable traits, like lust or aggression. Like I said, murderous rages, greed or envy. These are all things that work against our desire to present ourselves as model members of society, right? Like all of you in the room, right? No, you don't have any of these impulses. You're just good students, don't have lust, greed, envy. And in Freud's model, your early childhood experiences are the critical component, because most of the conflict that is addressed in psychodynamic therapy occurred during the childhood period. So you have to kind of go back and figure out what gave rise to the conflict and that what might be influencing your current behavior. So any drives or needs that weren't satisfied in childhood, right, they continue to influence our adult behavior. And that term is called psychic determinism in psychodynamic theory. The whole goal of psychoanalysis is to help the patient become aware or conscious of what was essentially unconscious. So we have unconscious conflicts in childhood. In our immature mind, we can't process them. We bury them deep in the unconscious. And then when we're adults, we try to get at those through with a therapist and use our mature mind to help us be able to tolerate some of the uncomfortable or anxiety-producing contents of the unconscious. And this insight leads to healing in the psychodynamic view. Okay, so Freud introduced, after the topological model, after he introduced the role of the unconscious in psychiatric symptoms, he went on to develop what's called the structural model. And the structural model is where he elucidated the idea of the id and the ego and the superego. Okay, and they're metaphorical constructs, although he did believe eventually neuroscience would find a place for them in the brain. They're still considered to be more of a metaphor or concept that's used to describe human behavior. And so in his model, the ego is our conscious mind. It's the way that we kind of operate in the world. So I'm talking right now as my ego to your egos. But yet, at the same time, the view is you have these unconscious desires that are housed in the id. And we have the superego, which is our conscious that helps us, well, that essentially tries to make us more model citizens in whatever society we were reared in. So again, to go into more detail, the id is the deepest part of the unconscious mind. It's instinctual, animalistic, primitive. It houses our deepest animalistic drives. And according to Freud, it's a source of all energy. And he called that libido. So it's the energy that fuels us. It's comprised of our biological drives, what you might consider the drives of the hypothalamus, right? The desire, sex, rage, aggression, and all the repressed personal memories. It also includes our just biological urges for food, for water, for nurturing. And again, this was all referred to by Freud as libido or life energy. But the id is illogical in psychodynamic theory. It can't differentiate between reality and fantasy. And that's why some psychoanalytic practitioners, they try to move away from egos talking to egos, and they want to have a direct line to the patient's id. And so they work in symbols to try to get at some of the unconscious conflict that's driving the patient. So the id operates according to what's called the pleasure principle. It wants to seek satisfaction of its pleasurable urges. It wants to avoid pain regardless of reality. So again, the id doesn't care about reality. It just cares about getting its drives satisfied. And the drives of the id continually press for satisfaction. So we need something that's going to mediate these drives of the id with the needs to become a model member of society. So that is where the ego comes in. So we're born with the id. And in Freud's view or in psychodynamic view, we form an ego in the first year of life. Okay? And so the ego then works to kind of make the id's impulses a little more acceptable. So it tries to kind of, it tries to meet the id's needs, but in a way that doesn't compromise the infant's, I guess, standing in society is a bit much for an infant, but I guess it doesn't want to get in trouble with its parents, the infant. So the essentially tries to be good in line with what the parent says is good behavior or bad behavior. So a kid might have an aggressive urge to bite another kid in preschool. And the teacher says, no, you can't bite. Biting is an aggressive, immoral urge. You have to suppress it. And so the kid learns to suppress that aggressive urge to bite or take a toy from another kid. And in doing so, it learns to mediate the needs of the id with the needs of society. So the ego operates according to the reality principle. So taking in realistic dictates from society and trying to mediate the needs of the id. And so the ego uses language, reason, logic, and active problem solving, kind of what we were talking about with the Piaget strategies, right? Over time, the infant develops the ability to learn what society needs or wants and then try to negotiate with the id. So the superego is what develops over time when a child internalizes the rules and regulations of society. And that becomes the conscience. So in a lot of artwork and a lot of literature and across religions, across cultures, you have this idea of, you know, the angel on one shoulder and the devil on the other. So the angel would be the superego and the devil would be the id. So the ego tries to mediate this conflict between a heavy duty conscious, you can do this, you should do that, and the id that says, just do it, you know you want to, go for it. Right? So the ego is like, I have to make everyone happy. I can't do this, but the id says do it. So it causes conflict, and that's the dynamic part of psychodynamics. So again, just to fill in the model a bit more, so this should say structural model. So the topographic model is the conscious, subconscious, and unconscious. Structural model is the id, ego, and superego. and the id is filled with all these shameful, repressed urges and memories and fears and violence, and it operates according to the pleasure principle. The superego is our religious values, our morals, and then our ego, or our conscious, and the ego operates according to the reality principle and tries to negotiate between the somewhat irrational needs of the superego and the id. Okay. Test your knowledge of Freud's structural model. Okay, so in this vignette, a 16-year-old girl is engaging in behaviors that we would consider in society to be somewhat self-destructive, antisocial. She's doing drugs. She's having sex in the woods near her school. She gets in trouble. She has to go to the school counselor. And over time, through counseling, it's revealed that she's actually suffered from a long period of sexual and physical abuse. And she shows no emotion when discussing the details of the abuse. So we can tell there's something going on there. There's probably something in her unconscious, some uncomfortable conflicts. But the question is simply asking us, really an easy question is, where, essentially, what's the origin of these immoral impulses, right, to have sex and to use drugs? So let's see. Yeah, so 91% of you went with the id. The id is the origin of those impulses. So the word immoral impulses gave it away. The id is what gives rise to these immoral urges, right? And then the ego is tries to negotiate them with the needs of society. So there are some defense mechanisms operating in this vignette. And we're going to come back to this vignette after you learn what those are so you can identify them. So we're going to start by just talking about what essentially these defense mechanisms do or what they are. So, as we discussed, the needs of the id, the ego, and superego are in conflict. That's what psychodynamics means. And when an unacceptable drive or impulse threatens to break into consciousness, our ego is threatened, our self-esteem is threatened, and then we employ defense mechanisms to maintain our ideal sense of self, our sense of self-esteem, right? If you grow up wanting to be a good girl, wanting to please your parents, then maybe in adolescence you have sexual urges, but you put them at bay because you want to be a good girl. So there's a conflict, right? And so the defense mechanisms are used to mediate this conflict. But they can be a problem because they can distort reality. And they do that to varying degrees. So there are some defense mechanisms that are considered more mature. And there are some that are considered more immature, and we're going to talk about that. So in overall, they're designed to protect our self-esteem and to help us feel better about ourselves and to shield us from the emotional pain and shame that go along with some of our deeply rooted drives or desires. But they do so at an expense because they distort reality to varying degrees. Okay, so the use of them is adaptive up to a point. Some defense mechanisms that we'll talk about are adaptive, but they become problematic when they distort reality and they impair our view of reality, which then makes it more difficult for us to establish healthy ways of coping. So less mature defenses, which we'll start with, like repression and denial, distort reality much more than mature defenses like sublimation or humor. And so towards the end of our list of defense mechanisms, we'll get into the more mature ones that through therapy, the therapist would want to move the patient from using more immature defenses to more mature defenses, which helps them be more productive members of society. So repression is one of the most immature defenses in the sense that some patients cannot tolerate the shame or the guilt associated with certain memories, maybe things that actually happened to them, so they repress them in their unconscious. And that means that the contents of that memory are inaccessible to awareness. Okay, so they're buried deep in the unconscious. And so, like if a child, for example, was sexually assaulted when she was young, but has no memory of the incident, she might later have difficulty engaging in intimate relationships because she might try to protect herself from some of the pain or shame or guilt that went along with that early abuse, but she'll have no memory of that early abuse because it was repressed deep in the unconscious. That's a psychodynamic view. And the course of therapy, the therapist would try to recover such content from the unconscious. Okay, now this has been very controversial because sometimes people claim to have discovered repressed memories and it's not clear whether things really happened or not. And sometimes people feel like the therapist has even implanted those memories. So it's highly controversial. But I just want you to understand the idea of repression is that a patient has memories that they truly push deep down in the subconscious where they're unaware. Now that will differ from what we introduce later, suppression. Repression is an immature defense where memories are truly in the unconscious. Denial is another immature defense that involves, so a patient cannot cope, cannot handle, their ego cannot handle the emotions associated with certain traumatic ideas or events, and so they will flat out deny them as if it didn't happen. So for example, if you have a patient, let's say you have a patient who has from deep or early on in his childhood this need or feeling to be completely taken care of, okay? And maybe he was neglected a little bit, so it's an insatiable need to be taken care of, to be dependent on other people, and to really just want to fall into the arms of a caring individual who will take care of him. But he grows up and learns that society doesn't value that in men. As a matter of fact, society says men have to be strong, dependent. So he can't handle the shame that goes along with his need to be taken care of. Lo and behold, a patient like that, who maybe had some early neglect, was never properly taken care of, so feels an insatiable need for it, but represses it or doesn't want to deal with that. So that patient can't handle a diagnosis, which will mean he will need to be taken care of. That's the logic of psychodynamic theory, that the patient cannot handle the shame that would go along with the need to be taken care of. It conjures up too much anxiety from deep in the unconscious, so that patient will deny that the illness exists, won't take care of what he needs to take care of, won't follow treatment recommendations because they're in a state of pure denial. If you ask, so this you might think is pretty extreme, but research shows that 20% of people who are given a terminal diagnosis will flat out deny that they have it, okay, against all evidence. So that is a defense mechanism, and what does it do? Distorts reality. And what does it also do? Make your job difficult. That's why it's good to know what it is. So some of you asked, well, what do you do if a patient doesn't want to know their diagnosis? You know, according to, we have the responsibilities of a physician to let them know everything. What if they don't want to know? This isn't healthy to not want to know, so you want to get them to a healthier place, right? So as much as you want to not think about these things, 20% of your patients might use very immature defenses, and you might have to deal with that. Maybe some referring for them for therapy in some cases might be warranted. So an abused child insists to a social worker that she's being treated well by her parents, so can't acknowledge that the same people that love her and take care of her also abuse her. So she completely denies it. She has to protect her ego from these, let's say, anxiety-producing, aggressive instincts toward the parents. So she just completely denies that anything is going on. That's to protect the ego. Or a patient denies any substance abuse or an inability to control it. Maybe they have a deep-seated need to control things in their universe because they have anxiety about things becoming out of control. That would be linked to Freud's anal stage, where kids first learn to control their bowels, and they have a deep sense of shame when they have accidents. If parents punish them or beat them when they have accidents, they develop a sense of shame and anxiety. So Freud would argue later in life they try to control everything in their environment, and they can't tolerate feeling of being out of control. So in this case, a patient might completely deny any problem. Grieving might be another form, and we talked about with the Kubler-Ross model that patients simply can't deny the death of another because they have a deep-seated fear of abandonment. Again, early childhood, if they were abandoned, if they were neglected, and they developed a real fear of it, they suppress it, and so then later on, anything that triggers these early deep-seated fears will cause them to engage in immature defenses like denial. Okay, so repression and denial are two of the immature ones, and so is projection. So projection is when you can't tolerate something in yourself, so you project it onto someone else. Okay, this might be when in a relationship, let's say a guy wants to believe that he's totally faithful, really good guy, would never cheat on his wife, and then he starts accusing his wife of cheating on him. He can't handle the idea that he might have sexual urges towards other women and may actually act on them, so he accuses his wife of doing it. So that's called projecting. And again, it's an immature defense. Or an MD who's sexually attracted to a patient, but that goes against his views of being a good doctor. So he believes, and unconsciously, he twists that into the patient is attracted to him. That would be projection. Or a man who has unacknowledged feelings of hatred towards someone from another race or ethnicity, but convinces himself that it's actually the other person who hates him, right? So that's an example of projection, when people can't tolerate a feeling, so they project it onto someone else. It's seen in paranoid delusions and in prejudice. So you can work with schizophrenic patients and actually hear the content of their delusions, and if a psychodynamically oriented therapist would try to understand what the content of their delusion is telling them about their unconscious mind, what maybe they're not acknowledging in themselves, but they project onto other people. Splitting is this tendency to split the world into people who are all good or all bad. In Freudian or in psychoanalytic thinking, it dates back to childhood, where an infant has difficulty understanding that the same mother who feeds, nurtures, takes care of his every need is also a mother that withholds milk, that withholds love and affection, that punishes. And so in an infant mind, these are two different people, until eventually they become merged or integrated, and an infant and a mature or a child can tolerate the idea that the mother is both good and bad. But an immature defensive style would be an inability to acknowledge or tolerate it that people can be both good and bad. So they're either all good or all bad. You see this when patients are in psychotic states in hospitals, they might split the staff into the good doctors or the bad doctors, or the good nurses and the bad nurses. One doctor is absolutely fabulous, according to a patient, and another's totally incompetent. It's very extreme. Again, it's a distortion of reality by ignoring all the good qualities in the bad doctor and ignoring all the bad qualities in the good doctor. Some spiritual traditions do this, where they say, oh, this other spiritual tradition is totally bad, it's wrong, God should punish them, and not see that all religions have some good aspects and some not so good aspects. So that's a more mature way of seeing people, or in this case, religions, is that nothing is all good or all bad. It's usually somewhere in between. But splitting is where patients regress to a more immature way of thinking about the world, which is all good or all bad. This is often seen in borderline personality disorder. And in general, in borderline personality disorder, one of the hallmarks of the are splitting, or repression, denial, a lot of these more immature defenses, projection. But in borderline, it's often characterized as this tendency to idealize someone one minute, and you know they think you're the greatest thing, you're so happy because you feel so flattered by this patient, and then the next day they think you're worth nothing. And you say, well, how is that possible? This is a patient's tendency to, it's all good or all bad. Regression. So we talked about that a little bit. When patients regress to kind of an earlier stage of development, more infantile pattern of behavior when they're stressed, okay? So when there's uncomfortable thoughts and feelings. So they might act out in more immature ways, and patients might use even more immature defenses when they are stressed. So in this case, if a hospitalized adult becomes really tearful and demanding, more childlike, right? Because in that case, they're so stressed. That's called regression, regressing back to childhood. Or if a child is jealous of a younger sibling that's born, for any of you who are parents out there, and you notice some funny behaviors when your older children have a new sibling, some of that would be attributed in psychodynamic therapy to a regression to an earlier stage in the kind of search for attention and more nurturing or warmth from the parents because they're jealous of the attention of the new sibling. Rationalization is when, now this is unconscious. Now we use the term rationalization in kind of a conscious way, which is I'm rationalizing something, I'm knowing I'm doing now. In the Freudian sense, it's unconscious. We rationalize things in the unconscious, so we don't actually know or recognize the true motives for our behavior. We give them a little bit more of a lofty origin than the real origin. And it helps us feel less guilt or less shame about things we might do that are really wrong, but somehow we rationalize them. So, for example, in war, we go and we kill people, right? But we rationalize that with some argument that the other country somehow wronged us. Sometimes it might just be as simple as we want more resources for ourselves and less for others. But countries usually don't acknowledge that. They say, well, you know, we've been wronged in somehow. So killing is acceptable within this context. It's one big rationalization for murderous behavior, right? Which killing other people in service to some loftier goal. That would be considered a societal rationalization. But on a personal level, if someone kills someone and they feel, well, he deserved it, right? In gang violence, you see some aspect of that where they say, well, he died, but he was worth nothing anyway, or he deserved it, or everyone else is doing it. This is kind of benign compared to the other examples, but you know, cheating on your income taxes and then assuming that everyone does that, really believing that everyone does that. Again, the key here is that it's hard because it seems like this is something we consciously do, but in the psychodynamic sense, it's typically in the unconscious, and we don't see it as a rationalization. We just see it as the reason for why we did what we did. We're just saying, I was just doing my job. I've got to make a living. Like, let's say a mobster or someone who, or you know, a soldier in a war who is asked to kill people but feel that they're just doing their job. That's a rationalization. Okay, displacement. That is when there's an emotion or impulse that cannot be released on its original target. So it has to be released on a more acceptable one, okay? So an example would be in this hierarchy of the medical world where you have the attendings and the residents and the medical students. The resident can't yell at the attending. Let's say the attending is abusing the resident. Resident can't get mad at the attending, so it displaces all of that anger and frustration on the next one down the pole, the third-year medical student. So that would be an example of displacement. Another one, people say, oh, you know, the essentially the boss is abusing an employee. The employee comes home and kicks the dog. So basically displacing anger onto a subject or into an object that is not going to be fight back or cause them to lose some stature in the world. Another one would be displacing love or affection onto an object. That would be, in Freudian sense, a cathected object. So let's say a woman has a long-term relationship with a guy who leaves her. She feels abandoned. It's intolerable. She displaces her affection onto a stuffed animal that she's all of a sudden sleeping in the bed with her every night. And then he comes back to her, and the stuffed animal gets kicked out. So that would be the cathected object in the Freudian model. And that's part that would be displacement of affection onto another object. Okay, we all use the term passive-aggressive. And if anyone thinks about what that actually means in psychodynamic thinking, it's when you have hostility, but you can't openly express it because maybe there's a power differential. So you express it in subtle, less obvious ways. Like, for example, in the workplace, by not being efficient employee. So it's this sort of obstructionist resistance or purposeful inefficiency, procrastination. It's not directly saying, hey, I'm angry because my boss is a jerk. It's actually not doing the work efficiently or effectively in a way to kind of passively get back. And so it's kind of a reaction. Usually there's some power differential involved where you can't act out assertively and say, hey, I'm angry because this is unfair. That would be a mature way of expressing the anger. Instead, because of some power differential, there are more passive ways of expressing it. So a physician might be really annoyed at the patient, and you're not supposed to get annoyed at your patients. So maybe acting out a little bit or passive aggressive would be to just not answer questions or deal with that patient. Or a patient who is really annoyed at the physician because they had to wait for a long time, and they felt that, you know, really bitter about it, but they need the doctor. So so they just act out in a way that's a little bit immature in the interview by not being communicative. So that's kind of a benign example, but it happens usually, again, when there's a power differential. And this is seen often in, again, borderline personality disorder patients or young children where they feel that they don't have a sense of power. That's why when we talked about dialectical behavioral therapy, part of the therapy is skills training, assertiveness training, and interpersonal efficacy training, because they'll act out in these ways that are less effective in the workplace or in interpersonal relations. So you want to help them be more healthy and assertive, even if there is a power differential, to be able to feel confident they can say when something is wrong and not just sabotage it kind of in a passive way. Reaction formation. So this is when there's an unacceptable impulse and it's transformed into its opposite. So it's fortified in the unconscious by being transformed into its opposite. So nobody's going to recognize it, because in my outside overt behavior, they'll see one thing and they won't understand that it's masking something deeper, which is the opposite. So a teenage boy, strict religious background, he likes porn, you know, pretty normal kid, and he doesn't want to acknowledge that to himself because his religion has been so harsh on it. So what does he do? He goes to school and he says, down with porn, nobody watch porn. Okay, that's a reaction formation. So he's transformed this unacceptable impulse from his unconscious to its opposite. Or, you know, this, oh, he really likes you, when, you know, a boy's fighting or, you know, with a girl and saying, actually, that's some sort of reaction formation that he's being mean to you because he actually likes you, right? So that's kind of a common parlance way of understanding it. So intellectualization is when we deal with difficult, uncomfortable emotions by focusing on facts and logic. So we can't handle the emotional impact of something, but we can tolerate, our ego can handle the facts and figures about it. So you'll often see this as a physician when you're giving bad news, when it's an emotional situation, you might feel the tendency to focus on the facts and figures in that moment, to intellectualize what's happening because the emotions might be too uncomfortable. So even the patient will engage in this type of process where they might use terms themselves that they research rather than talk about their own death. They'll talk about survival curves. Or the doctor will kind of join in on this enactment and they'll use terms like carcinoma, terminal rather than fatal. The example I gave you, expiring rather than died, that it's just kind of a way of distancing oneself from the emotional impact. Again, with the idea in psychodynamic theory that the emotional impact is intolerable, it conjures up impulses and anxiety in us that we can't negotiate with our egos, so we want to keep them at bay, and that's what gives rise to these defenses. Okay, so let's quiz you. We have more, but I want to just take a break and quiz you on your understanding. Okay, so we have a man who was abusing his wife, and his coworkers are shocked because they saw him as mild-mannered, compliant, and you know he never took it out on his boss, even though his boss was always hassling him, but instead he took it out on his wife. So what do we think that is? First of all, we can think about this guy as having some intolerable sense of inferiority, low self-esteem, that in order for him to bolster his self-esteem, he acts in aggressive ways towards his wife. But here we see that he's engaging in some displacement of his anger towards his boss on his wife. So the answer in this case would be displacement. Good. So most of you got that. Good. But let's keep going because we have more to get through. Acting out. So this is when you have a behavioral, emotional outburst that's used to cover up feelings of fear or inadequacy. So a child who's neglected might set fires in terms of seeking attention from his parents. Maybe there was, he never got that sense of warmth or being taken care of, and so he acts out aggressively and sets fires. An adolescent who gets into a fight or abuses drugs in order to mask feelings of inadequacy. So again, the intolerable feelings are the sense of low self-worth that date back to early childhood, but the defense mechanism is acting out. Or a teenage girl who binge eats in order to avoid feelings of low self-worth. Or borderline or antisocial personality disorders where instead of talking, using words, using logic to explain their anger and frustration in a mature way, they regress and act out in more immature behaviors. Isolation of affect is really interesting. Again, it's when some situation is so stressful, the emotion associated with it is so stressful that people will essentially isolate the emotion and not experience the emotion even when they're talking about the actual event. So a patient who is raped might describe this to her physician without any emotion. And that's often seen in trauma. Undoing is when a patient will do the reverse of some unacceptable behavior in order to undo or atone for that behavior. So this is becomes kind of ritualized. Patients will do things sometimes repetitively to try to atone from some shameful act. So a man who feels guilty because he's cheated on his wife, buys her a nice bottle of perfume. Maybe a woman who breaks up with her boyfriend writes him a note afterwards, and he said, why is she a sadist? Why is she writing me a nice note? She's trying to undo her guilt and shame by doing something she feels is nice, but he sees is not really appropriate. It may have a superstitious quality in some religions, you know, when they feel guilt or shame, and they might do things like counting beads or saying prayers over and over again. So somatization you're well aware of from Dr. Kirkby's lectures. It's when we rechannel these repressed emotions into somatic symptoms. Freud had lots of thoughts on that. He had famous cases of patients who had intolerable sexual urges towards inappropriate people early in childhood. In his case, it was usually himself or some adult male who never really clear in some of his cases where there was actual abuse. But he would say that essentially the female patients really did have sexual attractions, but they repressed them, and instead of being aware of them, they would come out in somatic symptoms. So patients that have a persistent cough, in his case of Dora, which he felt was linked to a repressed desire for her father's friend. It may be diagnosed as a disorder, but in Freudian sense or in psychoanalytic sense, it would have its origins in some, again, repressed desire that they're unable to verbalize, and so it comes out as a somatic symptom. Okay, let's test your knowledge again. Okay, so here we have a medical student who experiences really catastrophic loss because it will, in this sense, the damage is so bad, it will impact his career. So how is he coping with this devastating loss? Which defense mechanism is he using? Yes, 75% of you are right. He's using what we would consider a little bit more of a mature defense, intellectualization. So he's focusing not on the emotional impact. He's not talking to his friends about what this means for his life and career and all he's put into his studies so far. He's thinking about, wasn't it interesting, the technique they used in the surgery. So he's focusing on aspects that his ego can handle and not the devastating loss, the emotional impact of that. So maybe in therapy over time, he would eventually process the emotion, but this intellectualization is considered a defense against it. Okay, dissociation is when A patient will separate themselves from the full impact of their experience. Now, you did talk a lot about this in your trauma and stressor-related disorders, that this is right out of psychodynamic thinking, that essentially when we can't handle, again, the stressful or traumatic impact of an event, we dissociate. It's like we're not totally there. So a man who gets in an accident said it doesn't seem real. There's some aspect of derealization, as you talked about with Dr. Kirkby, like it's happening in slow motion. But in extreme cases, this would be a DSM disorder. Dissociation comes from psychodynamic theory. Sublimation is when we take some sort of unacceptable impulse and we channel it into a socially acceptable undertaking. So most people would argue that the whole development of psychoanalytic theory was Freud's big sublimation of all of his libidinal sexual urges that he then channeled into a brilliant theory about how the mind works. But it's considered a more mature defense. It distorts reality to a lesser extent. It's considered healthy in that people can channel their libidinal energy in a societally productive way. In this case, a man's angry at his boss. Instead of beating his wife, he goes to the gym and works out. Okay, so that's why it's more mature, and actually we all use this to some extent. The classic board review example is this: a student who has really strong, murderous, rageful impulses and becomes a surgeon so he can cut people and not feel guilty, right? That would be the example of healthy sublimation. Okay, suppression is when we make a conscious. Now here's, again, I told you the difference between suppression and repression is in suppression is conscious. We make a conscious decision to postpone something because it's causing us anxiety. It makes us uncomfortable. It can be a little bit maladaptive. For example, I suppress, anytime I have to buy an airline ticket, I get really anxious, and so I usually put it off and then it ends up being more expensive. So it's inconvenient. But that's an example of suppressing something that causes us anxiety, and so we might put it off. Not as immature as repression. So it's considered a conscious coping strategy. For example, you might have patients who they just don't want to deal with, you know, chemo or radiation. They don't want to deal with their treatment during the holiday season. They just want to feel good for a while and deal with the anxiety and the difficult emotions later. That would be considered suppression. Identification is when someone has feelings of low self-worth, and so they identify with someone of higher status or power to kind of bolster their self-esteem. So again, it's a defense against the intolerability of the sense of inferiority or low self-worth, that can't be tolerated. So someone focuses on identifying with someone of higher stature to bolster their self-esteem. So someone, you know, wanting to be friends with people of higher status, we call it like social climbing, would be an example of that. Or a medical student maybe kind of talking or acting more like than attending would be identifying with someone higher up the hierarchy. And Freud talked about identification with the aggressor. He introduced this concept that sometimes if cultures or societies are oppressed for a while, that its members might actually identify with the oppressor or take on the religion or value of the oppressor as a way of trying to bolster their sense of inferiority, having been oppressed for in some cases, many generations. So I saw a very sad case of identification when I was at Bronx, Lebanon. There was a young kid who had committed suicide, and so the psychiatry department was doing like a post-mortem evaluation of what went wrong and how did they miss this. And they described this example of how he was living in a home where the mom's boyfriends were abusing him, and he would dress in superhero costumes to go to school. And I always remember that as being very sad, because identifying in his case with a superhero was giving him a sense of power, superpowers that he didn't have in his real life to actually fight off the people who were traumatizing him. So that would be, in that case, a very sad example of identification. Okay, humor is considered one of our most mature defenses. Comedians might have some weird, strange impulses to do things that are societally inappropriate. Louis C.K. was in the news recently for this, but they might be really good at using humor to sublimate some of those societally inappropriate urges. So focusing on the funny aspects of a disturbing situation, you'll see this in your patients, joking about death. joking about losing their hair and hair and chemo. So this is quite common and considered not as psychotic or even borderline, but a more normal neuroses, basically. Okay, last question, and then we've made our way through the defense mechanisms. Congratulations, we got through all of them. The rest of the lecture you can look at on your notes on your own. It's just some interesting things about psychodynamic theory, but the defense mechanisms are what you really need to know. Okay, so we came back to our case, and I promised you by the end you would understand the defense mechanisms that this case was, that she was using. So let's just look at this. We don't see any evidence of dissociation here. Dissociation would be if she described, let's say, that if she was talking about the sexual and physical abuse by her father, and if we saw in the stem that she talked about it as if she wasn't there, or she felt it happened to someone else but not her. That would be something that would clue you into dissociation. She shows no emotion when discussing the details of the abuse. That sounds more like isolation of affect. So now we're between, okay, well, basically we've narrowed it down to isolation of affect. We know there's no dissociation, so we know it's A. Acting out is the actual behaviors, trying maybe in some ways to seek attention. But the hard question part here is, what is she actually repressing? In the psychodynamic sense, there would be some maybe murderous anger towards or rage towards her father, or even maybe some lust, some psychoanalysts would argue, or desires, sexual desires. But that's what's being repressed. But she's acting out, and she's showing in therapy some isolation of affect. Okay. So that's it for psychodynamic theory. I encourage you to read through the rest of the notes and read on your own if you're very interested in this topic. Thank you. Mm-hmm.